Welcome back to the Business of Government Hour. I'm your host, Michael Keegan, and our guest today is Dave Venturella, Executive Director of the Secure Communities Program at the U.S. Immigration and Customs Enforcement. Also joining our conversation from IBM is David Lipstein. Dave, effectively pursuing criminal aliens is no small feat, given the complex nature of your efforts. Would you tell us more about the significant challenges associated with identifying and removing criminal aliens? And what prompted the move towards this modernization, and you referred to this transformation of the criminal alien enforcement lifecycle?
The challenge for us really is, let me set some context here. ICE and the legacy INS have always pursued criminal aliens. At the federal level, it's easy for us to identify the criminal aliens going through the federal system because they serve longer sentences. The process is a little longer, and therefore we have time to catch up to the individuals that are going through that system, identify them, and begin proceedings against those individuals. The same is true at the state level. People are serving longer sentences, usually a year or more, and there are central intake points. The way that system is set up facilitates our ability to identify those folks and then, again, begin the process. At the local level, it's different. There are over 3,000 counties across the country. There are over 30,000 places where people can be arrested and booked into the system. And the speed by which the people go through that process is generally 4 hours or less. So for us, that was the big challenge. How do you close that gap? We're doing pretty well at the federal level, doing a very good job at the state level. But at the local level, we had a huge gap. In fact, I think we only had coverage of about maybe 30, 40% of the facilities, and not all of that was 24/7. That particular gap, along with Congress's interest in helping ICE improve its ability to identify criminal aliens, kind of led to this rethinking and this new approach and strategy, which is entitled Secure Communities, and kind of look at how do you close that gap? I can tell you that a lot of smart folks sat in a small conference room for many, many days and probably months trying to figure out how do we do this better? How do we do it differently? They said, hey, there are two biometric systems that Congress has need to be integrated, and that was the Federal Bureau of Investigation's fingerprint database and then the newly created DHS biometric database. And with that, they said, well, wait, if those two systems talk, why can't we get that information to help us do our job? Everybody from the federal down to the local level use fingerprints, take fingerprints, use the same system, and in return, they get information back, criminal history back. Now they can get immigration history, but we can also get that information at the same time. So some bright folks came up with that concept. It was discussed with our partners at the department and at the Department of Justice, and they said, yeah, this thing can work. That is really the cornerstone to our strategy, is this information sharing ability and leveraging that to help us identify people at the earliest point in the process and to be able to do it within that small window of opportunity that we have, like I said, generally 4 hours. We tested that initiative back in 2006 to 2008, and then in 2008, we went and launched interoperability as we know it today, analyzing all of the biometric records that we have in our DHS database and then leveraging the existing state and federal systems to get that information to us.
Let's take a step back for a second and define for us what exactly a criminal alien is and how big are the size and scope of that population. On a second part to that question, given resource realities constraints, how do you prioritize efforts and risk-based approach for enforcement actions to maximize impact on public safety?
Well, the definition of criminal alien is pretty simple. It's an individual who is a foreign-born national who is either lawfully here in the United States or unlawfully and has been convicted of the crime. They become removable in a case of a lawful permanent resident when the conviction that they have is of a felony and under the immigration statutes can be defined as an aggravated felony. So there are what you would imagine the murder, the rape, kidnapping type offenses would certainly fall under that. But there are significant drug offenses where sentences of a year or more, which can be imposed, would also qualify for an individual to become an aggravated felon. And if you're a lawful permanent resident, you can become removable if you're convicted of one of those types of offenses. For those who have no status, they are removable just based on their status, but then they become a criminal alien once a conviction is rendered against them. The size of the problem we've estimated, and that's one of the things that we started when we launched our Secure Communities program, is to kind of understand the size of the problem. No entity that we're aware of ever did a sampling of the criminal alien population, whether it was at the federal level or at the state or county level. So we took it upon ourselves to come up with an estimate of the criminal alien population in the United States and also come up with an estimate of how many of those would be encountered by local law enforcement. Now, again, these are estimates, and we're still developing some of the methodology to refine that estimate. But it's somewhere around 1 million individuals a year that will be encountered by law enforcement authorities that could be subject to removal from the United States, and then depending on the conviction, could be defined as a criminal alien. So it's a big problem. Our activity previously, we removed somewhere around 136,000 criminal aliens last year. The year before that, probably 115,000, and you know, the year before that, probably just south of 100,000. So you look at the number of people removed versus the number of people that come in contact, there's a gap there. Again, how do you close that gap? You got to start to be able to identify them very early on in the process. And you got to be in all places where they're encountered. And so, again, we thought the best approach was to leverage the fingerprint process to begin that identification. We like to say that by doing that, that gives us, you know, virtual coverage, virtual presence in these facilities. And again, we don't have to expend human resources to do that. We can leverage technology and we can leverage the existing infrastructure to allow us to be there. It's a big problem, and we certainly have a lot more to do to close that gap. But we think with this particular initiative, we've jumped many years ahead of where we need to be to kind of close this gap.
So I'd like to delve into Secure Communities as a mission program focus. And could you give us a sense of how it actually works in practice? And what is the mission of Secure Communities?
Well, the process is simple. Okay. Basically, when you're arrested by law enforcement in the United States and you're being charged with an infraction, generally, law enforcement officials will take your fingerprints and send them through their state system. Most police departments and other law enforcement entities can capture your fingerprints using, you know, digital capture technology and submit that electronically. There are still some agencies out there that use ink and roll, but the process is still the same, regardless of how you capture it. And that information is sent to their state identification bureaus. They operate their biometric database. They search their criminal records there. And then they pass it on to the FBI. Again, most of it's done electronically. Some of it is done manually. Then there is a search of the FBI criminal databases and indices. And generally, that information went back through that same automated system, and law enforcement officials would receive all the criminal history on that individual. In the past, if a law enforcement officer wanted to know about a person's immigration status, they could do a couple things. They could call the local ICE office and ask that the individual be interviewed. Sometimes an officer would go to the facility and conduct the interview. Sometimes they would do it over the phone. Another way would be to use a different system, a different electronic system called NLETS. And that system allowed the law enforcement officer to basically type in biographic information, so name and date of birth, and send it to our law enforcement support center in Burlington, Vermont, which is a 24/7 operation. And their primary function is to provide support to local law enforcement. That query could take minutes or it could take hours, and sometimes measured in days. because a common name, to narrow that information to one particular case record or individual could take a long, long time. Number of different databases, there's millions and millions of biographic records in those systems. None of them are interoperable. Mm-hmm. And so it took a pretty skilled technician to search all of those databases and come up with a response to the local law enforcement officer. Now, when the fingerprints are sent to the FBI, that search, that analysis takes place. Then that information is passed to DHS to do the same kind of search against our biometric databases. If there's a match, local law enforcement receives that message saying that there is a match, and then they receive subsequent instructions as to what is going to happen with that particular match. At the same time, our local ICE offices receive that information. So the messaging, the notice occurs at the same time. So whatever the law enforcement officers know, now we at ICE know. We've set some priority levels for our ICE officers and agents, basically giving them a guide as to which cases we're going to focus on. You know, I think it's obvious that we will focus on individuals who are higher risk, individuals who will pose a greater threat to the community if released. So those priorities are set. They're given to our field offices, and they basically implement those priorities based on the information that's coming to them through this identification, leveraging the biometrics that we receive. Behind the scenes, it's automated. It's electronic messaging going out to the end users, and it's happening much quicker. The identifications are, I would say, 100% accurate, and then it allows our folks to make better decisions based on the resources that they have available, meaning, you know, being able to prioritize based on offense and really the totality of an individual's history, both on the criminal side and on the immigration side.
So you've talked a lot about the use of the biometric technology. How has that increased your speed in identification? What's the cycle time right now that you're doing, and how has it overall improved accuracy of the results?
Well, we typically will return results back in about an hour. When we first launched the program, our goal was to do it in 4 hours. Well, we're exceeding that goal. As far as the accuracy, the matches are based on records on individuals that we've encountered before. So it's not as though we're pulling from a different source. We've actually taken and captured these biometric records that we have, whether they were from ICE, from Citizenship and Immigration Services, from the Department of State. These are all, again, biometrics that we take and then we maintain in the system. And there's some quality assurance procedures that go in place and make sure that we have accurate records and everything matches up. But it's very accurate, very reliable, and very fast.
It seems that the coordination and partnership with the various levels of law enforcement, federal, state, and local, have been improved through the early efforts of Secure Communities. Can you talk about how that sharing has occurred and how that's helping all the levels of law enforcement?
The cooperation has certainly improved. This basically gave us an opportunity to meet with law enforcement officials, introduce what our objectives were, making them aware of this capability. Basically, I think resetting the expectations about what ICE can do. And so it allowed us to go in there and have these types of conversations, understand their concerns, understand the local politics, understand their resource constraints, kind of work to bridge some of those maybe differences or misunderstanding, and come up with a agreed upon way of collaborating and working going forward based on now our ability to identify criminal aliens through this process. Again, I think created an opportunity for the law enforcement community to kind of sit down and understand the different challenges that we had. I can say in Harris County in Houston, Texas, the sheriff there will say night and day difference. Almost 2 years ago, there was a very contentious relationship with ICE at the time. They were having problems with criminal aliens. Couple of deputy sheriffs were killed in the line of duty. There was a lot of finger pointing. accusations that ICE was not stepping up and fulfilling their duties and responsibilities. Information couldn't be shared. It was difficult reaching ICE agents. And now that's all gone away. This ability to now know what is happening in those jurisdictions, but then also be providing a very timely response to them has been helpful. And then third is actually following up on those responses with, you know, taking people into custody, processing people for removal, or actually removing people from the United States. They're starting to see that in places where we've launched interoperability. I think the relationships have improved. We hope that will continue as we move across the country.
So this is really not just about technology. I mean, it's really about information sharing and collaboration in a lot of ways. I was wondering, you were alluding to your deployment strategy. Could you give us a sense of how you went about your national deployment strategy? Are you looking to accelerate that strategy and expand it?
Well, we took, I think, a simple approach to the deployment strategy. We looked at where the largest concentration or population of foreign-born nationals resided in the United States. And so as you would imagine, that would include large metropolitan areas as our first targets, and then kind of look at, as we deployed beyond those large metropolitan areas, where were the other large populations of foreign-born nationals living. But that's how we looked at the data and then came up with the deployment schedule. Now that we've been out there and we're in over 180 communities now, and there has been a number of successes identifying people who've evaded immigration authorities for years, who've been arrested and convicted, serve significant amounts of time for some pretty heinous crimes, being identified through this capability, we have interest in the law enforcement community. How can we get it? When are we going to get it? And so we're looking at that now and seeing how can we expand the capability ahead of our planned deployment schedule. And so we're looking at, for example, the state of Virginia, activating every county where we weren't going to activate the entire state until the end of fiscal year 2013. Our goal was to activate this capability nationwide by the end of 2013. But Virginia is ready. They want to activate all of their counties, and they want to do it soon. So we're working with the state on that, and we think we'll be able to accelerate that deployment in over the next couple of months, and we'll have the entire state of Virginia online with this capability. It just depends on the state's interest, whether or not technically they're able to do it, because there are some locations where, as I mentioned, they still use ink and roll, and that's certainly a criteria for us to determine whether or not they can go online sooner rather than later. And then whether or not we have the resources in place to respond to the uptick in the workload that we think is going to increase when this capability goes on. So, you know, we have to make sure that all of those pieces are in place before we can give the thumbs up to moving up a jurisdiction on the schedule.
How is Secure Communities a data-driven innovation? We will ask Dave Venturella, Executive Director of the Secure Communities Program within the U.S. Immigration and Customs Enforcement, when our conversation continues on the Business of Government Hour.